much for inviting me. I should say at the outset that those of us who are on the Academic Advisory Board, who are, I guess, everyone who's speaking here, we were asked to choose among various topics, the topics that, in fact, you see up here. And I actually put myself down for several of them, and I got this one, which perhaps indicates that maybe this is the least desirable topic. But in any case, I'm happy to speak to it. and also, the other thing I want to say at the outset is I'm glad to see that there are some younger people in the audience, and especially the two students from last night who attended my talk, Irina and Tanya, because there is a sense in which should you be pursuing a PhD if you don't want to pursue an academic career? And if so, why? Right? That should be a question that should be on the forefront of anyone who's about to graduate from this institution. And so it is important that this message get through to younger people. I am recording my talk. I put my talks up on my website whenever I can. And so, if there are some things you want to go back to, you can actually find it online. The first point that I want to make about the PhD, about the doctoral degree, is that the way that it is constituted now is not necessarily very good for conducting an academic career. Okay, so let's start with that. Because if you imagine an academic career in the Humboldtian sense, that what you're trying to do is do both research and teaching, and that in some sense this is supposed to be integrated in your sort of mode of being as an academic, and that in fact distinguishes you as an academic, we actually don't train people to teach. Right? The PhD is a research degree. Okay, and in fact, as the years have gone on, in fact, the difference between research and teaching has been magnified to such an extent that if a student is doing a PhD in the academic setting, right, they are told to focus on their research and to treat whatever teaching they have to do for income as just this kind of annoyance that you try to get through with as little difficulty as possible. So in other words, you're not really taught to embrace teaching, the teaching side of the academic vocation, when you're doing a PhD for academic purposes. So if you ever had the idea that somehow getting a PhD is sort of good training for becoming a proper, well-rounded academic, don't kid yourself. It isn't really suited for that. It is suited for training to do research in all sorts of settings, including academic settings and non-academic settings. And I do think that, you know, PhD training does provide you those kinds of skills when it's done, you know, in the best possible way. But I don't think it really equips you to be a fully rounded academic. I don't believe that at all. If anything, I think one of the consequences of, especially if you spend a long time doing a PhD and you get very much involved in your research, is to have a certain kind of contempt for teaching. Okay. I myself, if I had my way, I would not make the PhD a minimum requirement for getting a permanent teaching post at a university. I would want to see teaching skills demonstrated. Okay. Now, this is not to say that PhD could not incorporate those kinds of skills in the academic context, but they do not at the moment. It is somehow supposed that if you know something about a subject area, you somehow have the ability to teach it. Okay, and of course that does not follow. Okay, so the point here is there's an open question, you might say, as to what a PhD is for. Generally, it's not like it's obviously for, you know, it's obviously well suited for an academic career, and then why would you want it if you're not doing an academic career? No, I think a PhD is primarily a research degree, and research is done in many different institutional settings for many different reasons. And it's really not suited for anything more than that at the moment, the way it's taught in most places. So I think that's an important point to sort of get straight at the outset. Now, if we go back to the founding of the universities in the medieval period, in the 12th, 13th centuries, there is a distinction, because, you know, we nowadays think about the degrees in a kind of succession, bachelor's, master's, doctorate, and in some sense you have to get one before you can get the other. But it wasn't always like that. The degrees, in a sense, used to have just different purposes. It wasn't that you had to get them in a certain order. Now, in the Middle Ages, one of the things that's very striking, especially if you look at, sort of the medieval scholastic philosophers, is that some of them are masters and some of them are doctors. Okay, and there's a very interesting difference between those two kinds of academic roles. And in a way, it sort of prefigures a lot of sort of what goes on in the future with regard to the dual identity of a university. Because the people who get them, who are the masters, okay, are the people who, in a sense, are able to take bodies of knowledge understood as skills for life and incorporate them into their person. They are the people who are qualified to teach. Okay? And so these would be the people who would be expert in, you know, skills of, you know, logic and rhetoric and grammar, and you can add mathematics, astronomy, and music, because those are training the senses as well in various ways. So it's a kind of a training of the person. By integrating all the disciplines into oneself, one becomes a master. And of course, in the UK, you know, until the 1990s, basically, a master's degree was sufficient to get a permanent teaching post in a university. So this whole doctorate mania, you know, the UK is the last place to kind of fall for that. All right, and so you still have the master's degree as the kind of qualifying degree to be a teacher, someone who, as it were, can impart the subject to others, can exemplify the subjects to others, but isn't necessarily someone who's ever done some large-scale major research in the area, which is what the doctorate would qualify you for. Now, on the other hand, of course, you had doctors, and the doctors were doctors of the professions, and so you have law, theology, medicine. Now, what those fields are about, and what that degree empowers you to do, is to basically to administer over a domain of reality. So what that degree, so in a sense, you're operating in a somewhat different capacity. It's not equipping people for life so that when you're a teacher, you exemplify certain kinds of character of mind. That's what the masters would do. But rather, as a doctor, you're imparting certain kinds of knowledge and information that will enable you to rule over certain domains of reality. And that domain of reality may be your body, it may be your soul, right? You know, it may be some kind of jurisdiction, political jurisdiction. Right, and so the whole idea of having domains of knowledge in that kind of modern sense that we talk about when we talk about disciplines as having boundaries and things like that, that in a way is the university's way of internalizing this mentality. Right, so originally the doctorate degree was a kind of administrative degree to rule the world outside, but then in the 19th century, it gets brought back into the university and it becomes a way of ruling the university in terms of the disciplines that become kind of conceptual domains, you might say. Okay, and the doctorate degree then has that kind of character, and then what is it that you do when you get a doctorate degree? Well, you become someone who in some sense has helped to cultivate that domain. You've added, you know, you've provided value added to that domain. And you can see how then professional publications and things like that would matter in that context. Okay, and so what you have here then with the masters and the doctorate in the medieval context are sort of competing visions of what education's for. On the one hand, the masters, it's about educating the person, so you become this freestanding individual. And that's where we get the idea, you know, the arts, masters of the arts, liberal arts, freestanding, speaking for oneself, standing for oneself, which was quite a rare thing in the Middle Ages. So you had to go to university for that, to get that kind of training that enabled you to do that, to be able to speak articulately and so forth, and to combine all those different fields in yourself, right, versus the idea that you learn a certain body of knowledge so you could administer externally to the outside world some part. So you're a physician, you know, or you're a priest, or you're, you know, you're someone who has some kind of authority, external authority over others. And that's what the doctorate degree was for. It enabled you to lead others, literally. And then the 19th century, as I said, this becomes the sort of academic disciplines start to emerge on that model. But they hadn't existed that way before. Okay. So that's a kind of an interesting point here. And so I do think that when one thinks about the doctorate degree, one needs to think about what is the conception of knowledge being presupposed over which, you know, one says one has a license to practice as a doctor in the area. And it is one where we're talking about domains of knowledge, you know, that invite this idea that there are boundaries, right, that there are, that there's a, and so notions of expertise, specialization, all of those ideas kind of fall out of that. And you have a kind of image of there being a map of knowledge, and you're someplace on the map, but you're not everywhere. You never have God's point of view, right? You're somewhere on the ground. But over that ground, you may have control. Okay, so this is kind of the image I think you should be thinking about. Now, having said that, then you can imagine that in a sense, having a doctorate degree is quite a useful thing if you want to rule the world. Okay? Because one of the things that it enables you to do, you know, is at least to take a part of the world and to reconceptualize it in terms of the disciplinary expertise that you've been trained in so that you can govern it effectively. You give it a kind of logic, you give it a kind of order, and then you're able to sort of move within that, right? And others have already been persuaded that that kind of logic and order has some sort of larger social legitimacy. Right, so insofar as the university has a high standing in society as a place that accredits people, then you come in with your specialized knowledge about a domain enables you to exercise authority and control over it. And of course, the place where that's most, you know, evident, most blatant is, of course, the medical profession. Right, where in a sense, you know, once you become a doctor of medicine, you know more about people's bodies than they do. Right, literally, you know more about people's bodies than the people who've been living with them. Right, now that's real authority. Right, and that is kind of what the conception of the doctorate degree was about. And so it seems to me from that context, the doctorate degree is in fact a very, very well suited for you know, people who want to go into governance and power relations and things of that kind. And so I recommend it very much for those purposes. Now, what is it that you learn in the process? Well, I mean, one of the things you do learn, and I think this is, again, a very important thing, is you learn how to research. And that is to say, you learn how to focus your attention on a certain kind of subject area for a sustained period of time, and you go into it with sufficient detail and sufficient care, and you're mindful of other people who've been there before, and in a sense, that gives you a certain kind of sophistication, you might say, that you might not otherwise get through any sort of other training, where very often there's a lot of emphasis placed on being able to react quickly, spontaneously, cleverly, but not actually having to follow through stuff very much. So in that respect, the training for a doctorate degree, as long as the doctorate degree is not given in 30 minutes, and so there's an issue here about the amount of time it takes to do the doctorate degree, you actually need it to be long enough so that actually these skills can mature. Because they don't mature spontaneously, but it is part of what the strength of the doctorate degree is to allow people the opportunity to do that kind of careful research. Okay? The other thing, too, about doctoral research is, and this has a lot to do with the fact that we put it within a disciplinary framework, is that it forces you to engage in critical thinking with regard to sources. So in other words, you are not allowed to just believe any old thing. You're not allowed even to believe the most popular thing. In some sense, you have to justify the sources that you're using in terms of the kinds of knowledge claims you want to make. And so you have to see how all of these various competing knowledge claims sit together. So it requires that you develop a very kind of advanced sense of judgment of weighing sources in a way that actually has quite a lot of bearing on your own credibility. Right? Because if you do not assess the literature appropriately or well, you will not be evaluated appropriately or well. Okay? And again, this is a very specific setting where you are forced to do this. You cannot just believe any old thing or the most popular thing. I mean, once you get the PhD, you may revert to that. But you cannot do that while you're doing the PhD. So that's a very useful skill. The other thing about the PhD is that typically, I mean, this is of course less true in the natural sciences, I would say, than in the humanities and social sciences, but in terms of the history of the PhD, there is this presumption that you choose the problem. Okay? In other words, no one's forcing you to get a PhD. Okay? PhD is something that you voluntarily undertake. Okay? And your worthiness to do it has to do with your ability to formulate a problem. So if you're the sort of person who says, well, you know, I don't know what I want to do. I'm kind of a smart guy and I really would like to be at Harvard. Let me contact the professor at Harvard and see what he wants to have done. Now, admittedly, this is how we do things in the UK. Okay? I mean, there is a sense in which, because so much of the research done in the United Kingdom is driven by funding agencies and so forth, that you have these big projects, and the projects already specify in advance there will be these doctoral students who you can be training, and postdocs, and this is not just true in the natural sciences, but it's in the social sciences as well, right? And you advertise, right? So in Britain all the time, we're advertising for people to become doctoral students in pre-assigned areas. And all you have to do is kind of, you know, as it were, present yourself as someone compatible with that. And so you kind of repackage yourself all the time. And that's how you get your PhD funded in the UK. Okay? But that's very much against the spirit of what a PhD is. I realize that the political economy of neoliberalism is moving us in that direction, but that's in fact very much against the spirit of the PhD. There is a sense in which the classic thing about doing a PhD is you present a problem that you think is important and interesting, and the supervisor or the graduate committee or whomever say, yes, this person's got something to talk about. This person is worth supporting. Right? It's not like the person comes to you and say, I'm a smart person with lots of skills, hire me. I'll do anything. Okay? Because unfortunately in the UK, and not just the UK, but we are always on the cutting edge of everything, that this is very, you know, this aspect of doing a doctoral degree is often lost. The other thing that I would want to point out is, of course, a doctoral degree, because it is still primarily evaluated on academic terms, whether we're talking about publishing a book or publishing several academic papers, you're forced to confront primarily the academic literature when you're defining your position. So in a sense, you're presenting yourself to an academic audience in the PhD. Now, for people who are not going to be professional academics, this may seem a little constraining, but I do think one of the things that it does give you training in is in the idea of trying to position your message for a specific audience. Okay? Supposing you are a person who has non-academic intentions. You're getting the PhD because you do want to advance your career, you do think it'll give you some kind of competitive edge intellectually. Well, the point about dealing with the academic audience is it's kind of a well-defined audience. It's kind of a tricky audience, but it's not arbitrary. And the question is, can you present your message to them that they buy what you say? Whether we're talking about the examining committee or the journals that publish your articles. Okay? And that is a very good skill to have, because if you're going into politics or into business, you have to be selling yourself or selling your ideas to multiple audiences of all kinds. And here's a good, sustained example of that. Because the academic market is a very specific market. It has, and if you should be able to figure it out. I mean, as I think everyone in this room who's had an academic career knows, that you don't have to be a genius to publish in academia. You really don't. In fact, it sometimes helps not to have too many brain cells functioning, because then it enables you to focus. And that's kind of what we want when you're doing PhD. Okay? And that is a very important thing, being able to hit the market. And it's an academic market in this case, but it's good training. Now, in terms of, I'm going to wrap up here. Yesterday at the advisory board meeting, we were talking about different ways of doing the PhD, and you know, this traditional monograph way, and then there's this more modern way of doing it by publication. And I would like to suggest something that perhaps you might say might gear up a little way the kind of training involved in PhD, because I really haven't spoken much, and I don't know if anyone's going to speak about the actual training that you would get in a PhD program, right? It's one thing to say, you know, what's the value of having it, what should count as it, but in terms of actual training, what do you mean, you know, how does the training occur? I mean, there's not a lot of discussion about that, and historically that has a lot to do with the fact that the PhD has typically been a very kind of intimate relationship between a supervisor and a student. But I want to suggest the following, that if we're talking about a PhD for people who are primarily not oriented to academia, if we're going to entertain the possibility that you could be publishing in in journals, and you can have like 3 or 4 publications and count that as a PhD. I would like to go further along those lines and suggest a PhD by portfolio. That is to say that, and that portfolio would have to include at least one reputable academic article, but the other things that are included in the portfolio need not be academic articles, but could be things like videos, okay? Other evidence of, in a way, being able to translate the fundamental ideas and theses that you're putting forward, the sort of thing that you would be defending in a viva, okay, in your oral examination, being able to present that in multiple media. And the multiple media presentations of that would be the portfolio on the basis of which you would get the PhD. And one of the things that that would do, that would go beyond the sort of standard academic PhD, would be to show that you are effective in communicating a complex idea of the sort that is awardable as a PhD, but in multiple media to multiple audiences to show that that idea is actually relevant to them. Okay? And so I would say, you know, that if we are trying to encourage people who are not taking academic careers to get a PhD, then I think this would be this would really help. I think this would be it would be good training. It would not compromise the academic values, I don't think, and it would be a selling point for this, you know, because to me, to be honest with you, PhD by publications in academic journals, while it's very modern, I think it's very modern for academic life. Because academic life is this very discipline-based thing where we evaluate academics more by the journals than the books they publish these days. But if you're a non-academic, you know, if you're someone who's getting a PhD for non-academic purposes, I don't really see the value of having these kinds of, you know, publishing 3 or 4 academic journal articles. I mean, in a sense, it's really no different, or if not a little worse, than publishing a book. Okay? And so this is why I would say, you know, that having a PhD by portfolio, you know, would really be the thing, because it would show not only that you've mastered certain material in academic terms, but that you are able to communicate and translate it to multiple audiences, which is probably the context in which the person getting the PhD will be operating in the future, whether it be in commerce or in politics. Okay? And I will stop there. And okay.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your lively talk, and I think it was very interesting for all of us and to listen to your recommendations. What I learned, the basic message from your talk is we shouldn't be too much concerned about doctoral students who are not really intending a career in science. Because once they learn the way of tackling problems, it's useful any place in the world, in any career. And in order to achieve this capability of being a good problem solver all over the places, it's good to learn teaching while you do a doctorate. I have a problem. What do you do with doctoral students who see the doctoral degree only as a means for an end, who are not so motivated in doing scientific research?
Why did you accept them?
No,
I mean, why do you have such people? I mean, there is a sense in which part of what I was saying in the talk was that you know, when you think about who do you accept for a doctoral program, you have to actually ask the question, why are you doing this? Right? Because in a sense, it isn't ideally suited for anything, really. You know, maybe for an academic life, but that's only by convention, not because it necessarily gives you the skills that you need. But, you know, so you need to, you really do need to ask people that. And I do think that, in a sense, you know, insofar as you're advertising this doctoral program as being unique and special, you might want to flag the kind of student you're looking for, in general. Okay? I mean, so you don't run into this problem.
Well, it's not so easy to pick the right people. Selection is a problem. They are clever, and they can do scientific work to a certain extent. The problem is they are not really interested in deeply and fundamentally.
I mean, I want to speak to this point, and that's also towards the university, not only just for the sake of discussion, for practical purpose. I think Stephen was not using that word, that concept, but it was strongly implied that there should be a discontinuity with any type of previous academic education. So he said, you want somebody who does a doctorate, have the initiative and has the basic idea, you could even translate into a more Freudian type of language, the desire to engage with the problem, the curiosity about something. Now, institutionally, if you agree with that, you're in very bad shape in Germany, because if my recollection is still correct, the way it goes, you go to a post-seminar and you get an A+, and then you go, once you have an A+ in the post-seminar from the same professor, he will not give you a B- in a Hauptseminar. And then there's a certain expectation, one day, it says, well, you can write a dissertation with me. And then you stay at that court around the German Lehrstuhl, and end up doing that. Now, the American way, I don't know about the UK, is exactly different. In most institutions, any reputable institution, it is not allowed that the doctoral student be an undergraduate from that same... So our undergraduates at Stanford, I mean, even the most brilliant ones, and sometimes it's painful, are not allowed to apply for a doctoral degree at Stanford. So they have to apply at Harvard, Yale, or you name it, or Pittsburgh, or wherever they want to go. If they want to go philosophy, for example, you go to Pittsburgh.
That's where I went.
Very strong.
Yeah, that's where I went.
But, or I mean... Our undergraduates cannot apply. I mean, UC Berkeley recently, because of Stanford, because you have to say something bad about Berkeley, due to the financial problems of the state of California, was allowing their own undergraduates to apply for doctoral studies, and it was a big national scandal. Because, I mean, A, you get the feeling, well, you know, there's some homeboy kind of favoritism in there, but the discontinuity is what is really important. So somebody who applies at Stanford has to pay a fee for that. It's a symbolic fee, but you have to pay $100 to apply. You have to do postage. You have to prepare a portfolio to apply. And basically, you don't have to have a ready-made dissertation to apply, because that's the direction I want to go. And you say it's difficult. Yes. I mean, this month, in January, I would say, 30% of my working time goes, I'm in two departments, goes into grad admissions. I mean, I read for each department about, I mean, I read, but I skim through 100 files. We have two meetings per department, long meetings, open-ended meetings. And we come up with a list of 10, for example, in one department, and we try to recruit, and we try hard to get them. And it turns actually out, I mean, that can be no different in Pittsburgh, that the top, you know, let's say the top five of our list are people who also get offers from Harvard, Yale, Pittsburgh,
right,
and
right,
so
right,
forth.
Right.
And we recruit them as hard, or sometimes harder, as we recruit faculty. Which is a risk, because you don't know when they're going to work out. Yeah, I mean, at this point, we even have to compete with Germany, because there are programs like the Schlegelkolleg in Berlin, and so forth, and so forth. The point I'm making is, A, the discontinuity, they have to take the initiative, and that's already part of the process. Yeah, and B, that yes, it is a difficult process. So I would very strongly recommend, I mean, if students who are here from the ZU will forgive me, to have too many easy transitions. You need doctoral students to prove that you can do it, so you take your own students. I think that's not a good start.
I want to raise a point that will come up during the day, and I think it's come up now, and that is the different educational cultures that operate internationally. And I think we have very different cultures that within which the PhDs are emerging. Now, in Australia, the PhD is considered a requisite for a teaching degree. Now, in fact, we allow students to teach, but we do train them.
You do train them.
We do train them. And that's...
We don't.
It wasn't the case when I was doing it, but it's become essential that they are trained, because there is the expectation that will be, in Australia, a teaching degree. Now, they don't have to take teaching, and they don't necessarily have to use it. But in Australia, people who don't use their PhD for a university career are those who consider it to have failed to get in. You know? So it's a very different situation. The other thing is, as far as your own students going into a PhD program, that operates very differently in a country which is a small population and relatively few universities, located in cities, in basically four major cities. So raises very different, you know, cultural considerations. The reason I raise that is, of course, the whole point of this discussion is for them, and we need to think about, some of the general things you said are terrific, but ultimately we have to think about what is the culture, and how can we make an intervention producing quality PhD students in this culture.
But see, one of the things I would say, I mean, because the way I sort of imagine this university is a place that's training the future leaders of Germany or the world or whatever. And in a sense, I think the Plato Academy model is not a bad model to sort of use as your groundwork here. And I think what we need to do with regard to the PhD, and especially with the distinctive features of doctoral training, what makes the doctoral degree different from the other kinds of academic degrees, this discontinuity we were talking about, is to show how having those kinds of skills that make for a good PhD are ones you need to be a good leader. Okay, so in other words, we've got to make some kind of linkage there so it doesn't look like just a case of academics exacting their pound of flesh by forcing you to do a PhD in the academics way, but it has nothing to do with what you're going to do once you leave the university. Because I do think that's a real problem, in terms of the clash of the academic and non-academic culture, that's always a possibility, right? Because academics are always going to want to maintain the high standards, but they don't want to go the extra mile, which is to say, to show how those high standards actually help the people do what they want to do once they get the PhD. Okay, and I think that's the tricky part. That's the part that both involves a sort of marketing issue, but also involves some substantive issues with regard to how academics who are going to be training PhD students who are not going to become academics, right? How to think about what exactly is the value of critical thinking, of researching things deep, of having to choose your own problems, right? Of addressing very specific audiences like academic audiences. How are those very academically oriented skills useful for running the world or running a corporation or something like that? And I think that is the argument that needs to be made in a very clear and persuasive way. And I think this is where this university could sell itself in a way that I think would be, as it were, amenable to all sides of the issue. Okay, because we were in the advisory board yesterday, right? Quite justifiably, there's a lot of academic pushback, right, against, having the PhD program just driven by non-academic concerns because of the client market. And so what we've got to do is to show how the traditional academic virtues of doing a PhD actually makes you a better leader. Now, to be sure, that might not be everyone's cup of tea who might be thinking about coming here. But then we only want those people. We only want the people who actually buy this argument that there is a connection between the two. Yeah. And that's why I recommend that we play on an international stage. Right? Because there will be a certain market for this in Germany. But at the end of the day, I think this is an international issue. And this university is well positioned to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think if I could just add that I agree with that. You've got to separate education from training. Certainly, this is an education that they're getting, and those skills are going to be used in ways we may not predict.
No, but they have to have at least acquired the skills.
Yeah.
That's the point. They have to at least have acquired the skills.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're responsible for.
I have to watch the time a bit.
Sorry.
Yes, to catch a plane, and so
we both have to catch a plane.
We're on the same plane, and we're on the plane with this guy. We're all on the same plane.
He still has to give credit.
So that
Fritz and
Nicole. Three.
This university, if you have brilliant
Yeah, but you're not banning ZU students from getting.
No, I mean, they should have to apply, shouldn't they?
My just take the last comment.
Okay.
Assessors are. In the United Kingdom, we have external examinations. That is to say, the people who are primarily responsible for conducting the doctoral defense come from outside the university. And of course, by tradition, they come from another university in another department. But already there is precedent in the arts world. You know, so let's say, you know, you're doing a PhD in performing arts or something like that, that what is being, the thing being evaluated would not necessarily be an article or anything, and the person who'd be evaluating it would be someone who already works in that medium. So you could have a kind of, you know, you'd need like an evaluating committee of people who, as it were, come, you know, there'll be one, as it were, proper academic, and there might be other people, perhaps some people even from media, who are, you know, from the media world, who would be part of the evaluation process. I mean, so I do think I would be open to that.
And your comment to Fritz?
I don't know if I have a comment to him.
Okay.
I mean, in a sense, I kind of, yeah.
Can I have one?
Yeah.
No, just, of course, you're right. There are different continental national traditions. It would be idiotic under continental or German circumstances to not give a chance to the most brilliant students at your own university. But I do think, and I've seen that, I mean, I grew up here academically, that there's a certain laziness. Well, you know, they have been around my chair, they have been brewing coffee for many years, and that should be avoided. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not saying discontinuity, that you have only outside applications, but that you make a rigorous process of admission that applies to your own students too, that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's any disagreement on this point. Yeah, it's not about banning students from the home institution.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. Okay.
Fine with you're the chair.
Okay.
We're on the same plane.
Okay.
I would like to proceed with the point Friedrich Schneider made. I think we should look at you, Rob. We have now heard how it is in the UK, in the US, and in Australia. We totally forget that up to 1933, the Germans were absolutely top with the old university system. You totally forget that. And of course, the reason it stopped had nothing to do how it was organized, it had to do something with the Nazis. Totally different point. So we should look at why can we not take up the ideas which worked so perfectly well before 1933? The normal argument is there are too many students, but not at this university. So we could consider to learn what was the classical German university before 1933. Now let's look at today. First of all, in the United States, there are some few top universities, and the rest is absolutely lousy.
But the top ones are pretty good.
Lousy.
The top
we
ones are all ranked good in China.
If there was any university in Europe of this low level.
But we have no university system, I mean.
Now, where are the most which is the most successful country with respect to academic publication and careers? I'm afraid to say it is Switzerland. Switzerland. Academics publish much more and more successfully than Americans. So why not look at ETH, how they do it? I don't think that we always have to look to America or to Australia or to the UK.
See. No comment.
Okay. Now finally, we have the presentation behind us. Go ahead.
Okay.